You're listening to a WOSU Public Media podcast. Everything you hear is funded by listeners like you. Become a member of WOSU Public Media today and support digital content like Snollygoster and the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast. Make a gift at WOSU.org.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Marching band is a group of instrumental musicians, mostly on brass, woodwind, and percussion instruments, who perform while marching, often for entertainment during sporting events, especially football. They've come a long way since the days of John Philip Sousa. Now the choreography is complex and the playlists are ripped from the top 40 genre. Today we're going to talk about their history, culture, and impact. Jeremy Earnhardt is president and CEO of Music for All Bands for America. It's a nonprofit music education, events, and advocacy organization. Welcome to the show.
Good morning and greetings from Indianapolis.
When did marching bands get to be a thing?
Well, the first marching bands were in the late 1800s for entertainment, school spirit, and community purposes with colleges. And, you know, later after World War I, especially when musician soldiers would come back from the war, they matriculated into secondary public education, and the band movement in America really took off.
It really took off, but I mean, they just kind of started clubs and that kind of a thing. Is that how it started?
Well, there's all sorts of different genres. VFW would have kind of drum corps opportunities, you know, ways to keep kids off the street, as well as the merge from the public schools. And I think that all came together over the course of the back half of the 20th century. And then when Drum Corps International became a thing in the 70s, you know, there were some styles borrowed and some evolution that was created. And here we are today.
I guess that the male dominance of marching band culture is a function of the military origins.
Well, and I'd say we've come so far today. Mm-hmm. I have it on a good authority that someone on this show was in the U of M band, if that's true. So were both my parents. And my mother was not in the marching band because it was all male at the time. Obviously, times have changed. And I can share with you, with Music for All Bands of America, we run a summer camp at Ball State University each summer with about 600 enrolled in our drum major academy. And here is an opportunity, because band is co-ed, for a level playing field in terms of leadership development, and the majority of the drum majors are female.
Interesting. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the history and culture of the marching band. You know, I was in a marching band in high school. It was my favorite thing to watch at Michigan State when I attended Michigan State, but I was a flute player, and they didn't allow flautists in the marching band at that time. I think that's changed. But I'd love to hear from listeners who have marching band memories that they want to share, because I've got a few. Everyone's got some. If you were in a marching band, it's an experience. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, you know, like I said, you know, even since I was in high school 100 years ago, I can't believe how the music has changed. Back then, we were still doing the really traditional Sousa-esque marching band music.
Sure, and that development really in the 70s from what I'd call more military style, with the, probably you remember the 6 to 5 or the you know, show band for the colleges with the high step, really developed into what is called corps style marching throughout the course of the 70s and 80s. And while that visual developed, the music developed, you know, at the same time. And, you know, to be clear, it is a music-led activity, And then we were able to start to bring in, you know, more elements of what I would call theater and dance. And today's students that you'll see at Bands of America Grand Nationals this November, with 100 groups from all over the country, you'll see them demonstrating skills and abilities that, I'm telling you what, when I was in March, I couldn't do it. I don't think I could do it.
I remember when... You know, I was in band in high school. We did have competitions, but, you know, we were preparing for those competitions in a parking lot out on school grounds. We didn't have access to the field. I mean, the regard for the marching band is so much greater than it was back then.
So you have a group that is, in most schools, the largest school group, right? So just in terms of community and school spirit. And the way I look at it, and the way I think that many public schools have supported things financially, is from recruitment out of the elementary grades to completion of grade 12, you have a system of adult stakeholders that are charged with the positive matriculation of these students through the system. It's the one activity that you really get to have, you know, 6 to 7 years of contact time and help folks develop to become some great citizens and future leaders in our country.
What have been the biggest changes in how marching bands perform?
I'd say among the biggest changes are the expectation that we hear from all elements of the music ensemble. So you'd mentioned that the flutes were not allowed. Today, if you don't hear flutes, it's going to be a problem. It's also developed on the marching percussion side, from old time sling drums that you'll still see sometimes the military use, but even the Marines drum corps today will use modern marching percussion. And I just mentioned that the Marines are a sponsor of our organization, and we link with them closely, both in terms of music and in leadership.
What is modern marching percussion?
So we have moved from, you know, rawhide cow heads to Kevlar heads that are quite literally bulletproof. So both in terms of what they're made out of and how they're performed have really fundamentally changed over the course of the last 30 years.
That's what makes it so crisp and so commanding.
Absolutely. And so demanding. It's really hard to hide. You have a snare line of 3 to 5 to 7 to 8, and they all need to sound as one. It takes quite a bit of discipline and repetition to make that happen. One of the things I love about instrumental music is you have to learn the trumpet today the same way as you learned it 100 years ago, right? There's no shortcut. There's no app that is going to be able to make that happen. So that discipline that you experience as you gain skills and abilities on your instrument are the things that are going to be able to help you in terms of life skills as you apply them later on.
I learned to play by ear by marching in the band because it was easier to memorize the music than it was to have to carry that thing under my arm.
The lyre, yeah. Well, and I think that's another difference. The students today are expected to memorize their entire field show. And, you know, for us at Grand Nationals, it's anywhere from 6 to 11 minutes worth of music that they're going to be expected to perform.
Oh, and by the way, the movements on the field.
And the speed, I think, is another thing that has changed. You know, the marching with the marches was at about 120 beats per minute. All right. And we're sometimes at 180 beats per minute, 190 beats per minute at this point. So that expectation has certainly shifted. But to your point, it was necessary to be able to perform some of the more modern movie music, especially will be at that pace.
Right. I mean, I'm thinking about the music, the style, you know, and so on. You know, we just heard that was Ohio University playing a Bruno Mars song, you know, from the top 40. I'm just wondering about how much more complicated it is to choreograph with the styles of music that you're working with now.
Well, it really depends. Shows today will be thought of either led with music first or a concept first. So the choreography can sometimes be the thought process behind what drives the music that you find to fit it, or vice versa. There's really no one-stop shop about how to make things happen. And that's really, to my mind, what makes a high school marching band event such an exciting thing, because no two groups are presenting anything remotely similar. And every 15 minutes, you get to enjoy students achieving at the highest levels within a variety of ways.
How do you judge then if they're coming at you with so many different interpretations of the experience?
Well, our adjudicators with Bands of America are really the kids' fans. They want them to be awesome. And what we have developed over the course of 45, 46 years are a series of seven rubrics for seven different adjudicators that all have a specific role or responsibility. And then all of those scores are then combined to yield the final level of achievement. And, you know, 40 years ago, it used to be what they called a tick system. They would wait for a kid to do something wrong and go tick, tick, tick. So you'd start with 100 and go down. And we are quite the opposite of that today. Mm. And especially this year, after taking what will have been 22 months off this uniquely American activity, we are going to be in a support capacity in every way to let those kiddos show off what it is that they can do.
And what about the issue of wealth? Because I can imagine that wealthier districts can support bands in a more lavish way. What about that? How do you create an even playing field when it comes to instruments themselves, uniforms, blah, 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 all that stuff?
Always a challenge. And I'll share with you, prior to coming to Music for All Bands of America 4 years ago, I was involved in two high poverty mid-urban school districts in Texas, Irving and Arlington. And what we did was build consensus and used school bond or referendum programs and asked the question, would you support the funding of instruments for students who otherwise couldn't afford? And in a Tea Party town, the answer was 70% yes. Mm. And that bond package passed by 70%, allowing for 9.8 million in instruments and uniforms to create equal access for students across the school district. So it can be done.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
So I am a band director now, but I started off in high school marching with a competitive band in a small town in New Philadelphia. And I found it to be a really enjoyable and challenging experience that shaped me throughout my own personal career, but in definitely my professional career. I find that working on a single show for an entire summer and then performing it at competitions throughout the fall, you can get that high level experience of polishing music, of getting your marching down, of changing forms, of seeing what that does when you're one of 130 on the field. I found it to be a really exciting and enjoyable experience, and it's one that I still miss as a band director that just kind of does halftime shows now and that kind of don't have the competition part of it. But just wanted to just kind of go through and just go through my experience and say that I really found it enjoyable. Yeah. And I love teaching music now as a director.
Well, thank you for doing that. I appreciate it.
Chris, thank you for being a teacher. And especially a band director can sometimes be kind of a thankless profession. Everybody has an opinion about how you should be doing your job. And, you know, here at Music for All, we are about building leaders, celebrating teaching, and the art of excellence, which is exactly what you're describing being able to achieve over the course of that season.
I am going to take one more quick call before we end the... Chris in Pickerington, you're on the air. Oops. Okay, I guess not. Oh, wait, Chris in Pickerington, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
My name's Chris. I am a band director and percussion instructor at Pickerington High School North and the Pickerington Local Schools near Columbus.
Uh-huh.
Very good.
And I was just looking forward to talking to you here today. I was listening to the show, driving between schools where I teach, and surprised to hear talk of marching bands. So I just wanted to call in. I, like I said, I'm a percussion instructor, And I appreciated the little conversation you had about the development of marching percussion, and just wanted to add the development of what's called the front ensemble or sideline pit percussion. That is all the large instruments on the sideline, marimbas, timpani, things like that, that actually used to be marched with in the 70s and even early 80s, and has become a really critical part of marching percussion and what marching bands do. And
Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
And the other thing I wanted to mention was that I am a member of the Ohio Music Education Association, which is a professional organization, of course, of Ohio band directors, choir directors, orchestra directors, of course. But we sponsor local marching band events at many high schools, dozens of them through September and October. And so anyone interested in seeing marching band on a sort of a concert stage, not just at a football field in a football game, but in a place where you can really hear and see everything, you can look for those opportunities at local high schools in your area.
Okay. Well, Chris, thanks again. Thanks for your work. Appreciate it. Thanks for the call, too. I have to say goodbye to Jeremy Earnhardt. Jeremy, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Jeremy Earnhardt is the president and CEO of Music for All. It's a nonprofit music education, events, and advocacy organization for high school marching bands. We are going to continue our conversation about the culture and the history of marching bands. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. That is the Ohio State University Marching Band performing, it sounds like, in a live performance at an OSU football game. We're striking up the band this hour, looking at the history and culture of marching bands. The marching bands of historically black colleges and universities are viewed as some of the best in the country. Two of the best, according to national rankings, are the Grambling State University Marching Band, also known as the Tiger Marching Band, and the Tennessee State University Marching Band, known as the Aristocrat of Bands. Nicole Roebuck is chair of the Department of Music and director of bands for Grambling State University. Welcome to the show. Oh, I guess she's not here yet. Reginald McDonald is director of bands, coordinator of instrumental music, and associate professor of music education at Tennessee State University. Welcome to All Sides.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So when did it get to be this flash and energy at historically black colleges and universities and their marching bands? How did that evolve?
So the history of the bands at HBCUs are somewhat unique. Our early history kind of follows the similar passages as Ohio State and Michigan and schools like that. But once the 50s, 60s, and 70s came about and people could pursue degrees in music education, a lot of the bands started to take a unique turn. And that turn came about because a lot of the early band directors for HBCUs was educated at some of the Big Ten schools. Take my predecessor, for instance, Mr. Graves, who was the band director here from 1979 to 2014. He earned his bachelor's degree here at Tennessee State, but when it was time for him to go pursue his master's, he wanted to pursue his master's in his home state of Mississippi. And at that time, he just couldn't go to school at the University of Mississippi. So the state of Mississippi paid for him to go to Illinois. And that was a similar route for many of the early band directors of HBCUs, where they were educated at their particular alma mater, And then when it came time to pursue graduate studies, the majority of them pursued graduate studies at a Big Ten school. And so when you look at the style of the HBCU bands, and you go back and look at footage of the Big Ten schools from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you see a lot of similarities. And that's where the HBCU bands start to evolve. As these guys was educated at, let's say, a University of Michigan, and they studied with the renowned Dr. William Rivelli, they came back to their institutions and employed some of those teachings, and then also added their own little twist to what it is we do today.
And where'd that twist come from?
Well, the twist is a little bit of a cultural thing in terms of some of the unique things in the African-American community. And one of the unique things in the African-American community is our ability to innovate different genres of music. And so a lot of those genres come out in the marching band. And, you know, anytime you're dealing with music, you know, people start to get happy feelings and feeling good about it, and it just caused you to move. And so those things also have been employed onto the marching band field in the HBCUs.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the history and the culture of the marching band. You just heard Reginald McDonald. He's director of bands, coordinator of instrumental music, and associate professor of music education at Tennessee State University. Also with us, Nicole Roebuck. She's chair of the Department of Music and director of bands for Grambling State University. Welcome to the show, Nicole. Hello, Nicole. I think you're on mute.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Both of these, Grambling and Tennessee State, are two of the best marching bands among historically black colleges and universities, and among, I guess, the entire field of marching bands in this country. If you have a question or comment, you want to tell us about your experience in marching band, I know I could sit and talk. I want to talk about my experience. I mean, it's anyone who's been in a marching band just automatically has a whole pocket of memories. If you have one you want to share, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Nicole, I was just talking with Reginald about, you know, where the flash and the energy comes from with HBCU's marching bands. It's a little bit different, but I feel like it's also influencing bands across the board. What are your thoughts?
Yes, the flash and the high step and the, you know, what we call, marching 90s, or, you know, it's a tradition. It's history now, something that was embedded and engraved from a lot of programs from our legendary band directors. These were visions that they put into place. And I say now it's our job to make sure that those traditions are still intact, and then we put our own spin on it and make it even better.
The whole marching band experience is such a joyful one for everybody. When I everywhere I read and was prepping for this, and my own experiences, it's just, there's something, it's sort of like exercise. It does something to your body, and it just makes you happier. And that goes to a lot of the cut-up culture of marching bands, the fun of the whole thing, Reginald McDonald. Sometimes the fun gets out of hand, and there's also new focus on, I hate to use the word reining in, because you don't want to do that to these college mm-hmm. students, but how do you sort of manage the ecstasy and the agony of the whole experience and keep things in line these days?
So early on in my career, I was a middle school and a high school band director in the Atlanta area. And I had a music supervisor one time use the expression of giving students a little of what they want and a lot of what they need. And that's kind of a philosophy that I've kind of stuck with throughout my career, in terms of some of the things that the students want to do, like play some of the pop tunes and do some of the latest dance steps. But then I also have to keep in mind that I must manage with what they need in terms of making sure that I provide a positive music education experience for the students, making sure that they develop on the instrument, but also do some things to help them cope with life and be successful in life beyond the band room. And so those things entail discipline. Sometimes it's a little bit of tough love. Sometimes it's just a hug. You know, it just depends on what that particular student need at that time. And so our goal, and I'm sure Nicole shares the same mindset that I do, that we want to develop kids that can leave our band program and be successful in any arena in life, whatever their chosen discipline is. And so they start to develop the foundation for working hard in our band programs. And not just our band programs, but I heard the clip of Ohio State Band and Michigan and some of the great band programs throughout our country, FAMU and Southern and places like that. All of us have the same mindset of, number one, we want to develop good musicians. We want them to play well and march well, and we want them to have fun in the marching band. But our ultimate goal is to make sure that we develop young men and women that become productive citizens, not only in our country, but in our world, where they can go in any arena of life and look at the challenge before them and not feel overwhelmed, but they look at that challenge and say, I know how to be successful at this, because in marching band, we start from the unknown and go to the known.
Yeah, Nicole Roebuck?
Yes, I share some of those same thoughts. I was a middle school and a high school director, and just learning early on in my career that, you know, they want the fun. They want the fun music. But it's our job as music educators to give them, you know, that technique, whether it's, you know, some long tone, some chromatic studies, just to give them that and to teach them that that's the foundation. And without a foundation, the house will not stand. And so that's my philosophy. And even now, teaching in, you know, on the collegiate level, we have to sometimes pry those foundations out of them. They want to go straight to, you know, those R&B and rap songs, and we have to dial it back some and just let them know, hey, the foundation is important. And I always use the example, it's like a person getting ready to run a marathon. Well, you know, they just don't go straight out and start running. You have to warm up first, and you have to learn correct techniques. So I instill that in my students, and also how to be successful, not only on the field, but also in the classroom. And that's an important thing. And from their freshman year, I say I preach, and the kids say I preach a lot, that your goal, we want you to enjoy your experience in the world fame. But the ultimate goal is for you to get a degree.
That's right.
In 4 years, you know, we don't want you to make marching band a career for you. You know, we want you to get in. We want you to enjoy the experience and, you know, move on with your life and become a productive member of society. And I just say all the time, for me, it's more than music. I think about all of the band directors and educators that poured into me. So I look at it now as my job and my purpose to pour back into my students, you know, not just those musical skills, but, you know, a skill set where they can be successful later on in life.
Let's hear from Sarah in Pataskala. Hi, Sarah, you're on the air.
Yes. I marched with the Middletown High School Band back in the late 60s. And just have wonderful memories of being in the stands and cheering the team on, getting out on the field. And one occasion it was in mud so deep that we were losing shoes.
Yes.
Because the football team had been out before us, cleaned up the whole darn field. Just wonderful memories, a lot of good teachers, a lot of fun. You learn the rules, and one of the first rules is you never let go of your saxophone because it will come back up and hit you in the mouth.
That's a good rule.
I have two chip teeth that I have to get recapped about every 10 years as a memory of that.
Me too.
Oh my gosh! Thank you, Sarah, for those. Those are great memories. Yeah, the chip tooth thing is a real deal.
It is.
Thanks for that call. You know, I first of all, Nicole Roebuck, I wanted you to tell us what the fifth quarter is, and then I've got some cuts I want to play. So tell us what it is.
Well, you know, the fifth quarter has been something that's developed over the years. When I was in school, we didn't do a fifth quarter, didn't do a zero quarter. You know, it was all about the halftime show. But in recent years, you know, halftime is one aspect, but the zero in the fifth quarter is, you know, it's almost like the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
You know, the halftime is the cake. And then the zero and the fifth is the icing on the cake. And you have just as many people left in the stands watching the fifth quarter as you do watching the game. And they wait for it. They're looking for
it. It goes, it's a back and forth thing, right, between the two schools' bands.
Yes. Usually we do what we say, five and out. Both schools do five songs. You know, you just pick your best five songs. Sometimes we might go six or seven, depending on the venue where we are. But, you know, the fifth quarter, it's exciting. It really is.
Well, we have some sound from this year's fifth quarter matchup between Grambling and Tennessee State.
Oh, wow.
So let's hear from Tennessee. Let's hear a bit from Tennessee State real quick. Beautiful. And now let's hear from Grambling State. That just makes me happy just listening to that. And when you're listening to it, Reginald McDonald, can you picture the band in your mind moving?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That was a great memory that probably be etched in my mind for a long time, considering just all of the dynamics that played into not just my band, but Nicole's band being there and all the college bands across America, just getting to the point where we come in, starting to come back to a sense of normalcy, if you will,
yeah,
and all of the different inter things that play a role in all of our bands getting into a position where we can actually have enough students to perform. And so that memory will be forever etched in my mind. And I was also honored that day that my predecessor, Mr. Graves, who's now retired, his daughters moved him from his house in Nashville to move him to Ohio so they can take care of him better. And he spent the day with us over on the stands and on our side of the stands and came out at halftime and watched the halftime. And we actually watched Nicole's halftime after we finished. And just to hang out with him and just thinking about all of the dynamics that it took to get both bands to that point and performing and all of the people that was there. It was just, you know, one of those things that prior to 2020, everybody just kind of took for granted. Mm-hmm. And so after our experiences last year, I'm just in that mindset that things like this, I don't take for granted anymore. And it will be etched in my mind for a long time. That was a beautiful day in Canton, Ohio that day. The NFL Pro Football Hall of Fame treated us well. And so just a great experience.
Nicole, any parting thoughts?
Oh, you know, 2020 took us through a lot of changes. And like you say, there are things in life that we can take for granted. And when they're no longer a part of us or we can't do them, we know what they really mean. And I've always known in my heart that I'm a music educator, and not to be able to, as the kids say, hit the field, and even though it's a lot of work and, you know, a lot of pressure that comes with preparing the show, we miss that, you know, and I really, really miss that in 2020. And for us to be back and able to travel and just have that bond and connection with our students again, you know, it's awesome, because my students play a huge part in my life. And And, you know, they mean the world to me. You know, I treat them. I have a 16-year-old son, and, you know, I treat all of my students just like they belong to me. So for to have us back and back in the band room and traveling again, you know, it's the greatest thing ever.
Well, it's been great having both of you on the show today. I really appreciate your time. I know you're really busy. Nicole Roebuck is chair of the Department of Music and director of bands for Grambling State University. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And Reginald McDonald, director of bands, coordinator of instrumental music, and associate professor of music education at Tennessee State University. Thanks to you as well. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed myself. Thank you.
Okay. And listeners, I'm still looking for those high school memories. Maybe it's college memories of marching band. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Marching band halftime shows are as much a college football tradition as the games themselves. The precision, showmanship, and ability to rile up those crowds makes them an integral part of the college football experience. And it all starts, for most of them, in high school. This weekend, the University of Dayton Pride of Dayton Marching Band will host the bands of Southwest Ohio Regional Championship for High School Bands. Kenneth Will is director of the Pride of Dayton Marching Band at the University of Dayton. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. We're excited for this weekend.
Listeners, were you a member of your high school or college marching band? Share your memory with us by email at allsides@wosu.org or by phone, 614-292-8513. How big of a deal is the high school competitive level of this?
Well, it's an extremely big deal, especially in this region. We have so many great bands from Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, who are all competing and coming to this regional of this upcoming weekend. And it's a really big part of the culture in this area. And I know that we've heard from some callers already today who talk about their experience in those competitive marching bands and in getting ready for that competition. And I think for them, any one of them would say it's not all about the rating or about the score or about the award or place that they get at those things, but it is all a part of the process of doing it, you know, striving for excellence and doing the best that you can.
What's the fellowship like between the bands?
That's a really good point. The bands that are competing in these week to week, you know, you're seeing each other every 2 weeks, and in some cases, and you get a little bit of a friendly rivalry that sometimes can exist between those bands, and I see it because they come end up coming to college and doing marching band, and then I have these students from these two rival high schools who already know each other. They already are friends with each other. They already they give kind of friendly jabs about, oh, we came in second at this or whatever. But it's always in the spirit of that friendly competition, and especially when they're coming together in a group like this, where now they are part of our family.
I'm going to take a call from Joanne in Columbus. Hi, Joanne, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to let you know that there's going to be a big float in the Rose Bowl about band directors. There'll be 290 band directors marching with a great big float. Mr. Sewell, who was the head of music at Pickerington Central for many, many years, he's being honored. This all started through him. But so watch the Rose Bowl. It'll be a whole big thing about band directors, and they'll be marching.
I'm glad. Thank you, Joanne, for that call, because I wanted to talk about the band directors for a minute with Kenneth Will. Kenneth, I mean, you know, it's been we just had a couple greats on. I'm just thinking about, it's sort of an unsung hero. You see the band out there, but you usually don't know who the director is.
And I think most of us prefer to keep it that way. You know, we want to pass on that standing ovation you get at the end of a halftime show or at the end of your competition. That's for the students. You know, they're the ones who have earned that, and we want them to be at the front of these programs. But speaking to those teachers now, you know, there is so much thanks to go out to all of them for all of the hard work, the talent, the perseverance, and the strong leadership that goes into creating any of these programs. It's hours and hours and hours of time and work from these teachers, and it's really inspiring.
I mean, just in the last 20 years, it's probably changed a lot, right?
Oh my goodness, yes. The last 20 years, I can think the
last 10
one
years.
Of the biggest, yeah, sure. One of the biggest innovations for me personally is social media and YouTube. You know, college marching bands in particular, they don't show halftime on TV. You're not going to find that. So
that is a sad situation too, by the way.
Right. And so it used to be that the only way you could see the show is you had to be in the stadium. You had to be at the game,
right,
and not eating nachos during that time.
Mm-hmm.
So now with the advent of YouTube, we see every week there's a new marching band that's going viral, trying something new. And I think that it has taken any of the gaps or bubbles between competition band, HBCU, college show bands, like all of these different places where sometimes you can find your niche and get a little bit too comfortable there.
Mm.
All of a sudden, we're watching what other bands are doing in other genres, and we're learning from them and starting to incorporate that more into our performances. I mean, I spend on Sunday mornings before, you know, any NFL football game comes on, I'm on YouTube just watching college marching band show after what was everyone doing yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really neat thing that we can do now.
It's neat, but it feels like pressure.
It can be for sure. I think we all kind of share that pressure. And I think one of the things that's inspiring about these teachers that we're talking about is just how much we kind of thrive on that kind of pressure and, you know, internalize it for us and create a package where we can then teach our students without passing that pressure on to them.
You mentioned, especially in this region, when it came to the enthusiasm and the bands that are participating coming up in the events this weekend at University of Dayton. And I'm wondering what makes the Midwest a strong haven of marching band talent? Is it a function of our interest in football?
I think it band and football have a great cycle relationship since the start of, you know, academic and scholarship football in the early 20th century. That's really where band got into the game too, started performing on football fields with lines. And then those lines allowed us to have coordinates to plan our shows. And then those just grew and grew and grew and to what we have here today in 2021. So the strong football culture certainly has helped with us. And then you just have these great band directors who have then passed on their love. And Jeremy made the great point of those people coming back from World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really big. And then going through our great music education programs here in the Midwest. And then we see those teachers create new teachers. They create new teachers. Or if they're not creating new teachers, they're creating new parents to go out there and support the programs and become band boosters, or just people who are out there cheering and supporting these teams. And that's just as important as all of it. So all of these groups working together in the Midwest is just a really happy marriage to make so many successful programs.
Musical tastes differ. You're playing for a diverse audience. How do you select the music your marching band will perform? How's that changed over time?
So for us, we sit down and take a look at what our audiences are going to be. So for the University of Dayton, it is going to be our college students. That's our main audience. And then we're going to have the parents of those students. So what was the music in their generation? And then our third big group is going to be our alumni base. So where are they coming through? What were the hits that they played whenever they were in the group, the songs that they love, and kind of our standards that get passed down throughout the years? So that's our audience, and then we plan around there. So for a show or a band like us, where we are creating a new show for every single home football game, we'll take in, so our first game is top 40. You know, we're playing the hits that are on the radio right now that our students who are in the band, the students that we're performing for, are really going to love. Our next show is going to be something that's tailored a little bit more towards their parents. But, you know, we found whenever we announced that, all of our students were like, "Y'all, right, yeah." They were really, really excited mm-hmm. about that show too. So, you know, parents pass down music to their kids, and I can say that too from my dad, the music taste that I have. And then our alumni base for our homecoming show, we're going back and pulling up some standards that they played through the years, and we're gonna do a tribute to Broadway since it's been 18 months since there's been Broadway too. Mm-hmm. So, and that's finally, the lights are coming back on Broadway.
What about traditional John Philip Sousa-esque stuff?
We find a lot of that in our traditional school songs. Okay. You know, those were written in the 1920s.
Right.
So we have, for us, Victory, our fight song, and Loyalty March. Those were both 1922 and 1925. You can hear those traditional march, you know, forms. You have, you know, AB break strain, and then your trio section, like all of that kind of stuff exists in those charts. But you're not going to find a lot of John Philip Sousa, but you will have, you know, the occasional Stars and Stripes Forever, and you're doing something patriotic and those sorts of things.
The choreography is amazing. And, you know, you've achieved, you and the Pride of Dayton Marching Band have achieved notoriety because of your popularity around the world, you know, on YouTube, performing, you know, I'm just wondering how you choreograph these from 1 week. Is this something that you're working on all year long, devising shows?
Oh, it's something that certainly we start thinking about immediately. I mean, I'm already thinking about things that could possibly work for next year that would be cool. So it's a year-long process. And you're taking ideas from students, you're taking ideas from, again, alumni, you're taking, we have a great staff that I work with. You know, Jim Leslie is our Russian instructor and assistant director, and he's always a good sounding board for me to bounce ideas off of. And we have two color guard directors, Jonathan Gilman and Vicky Dish, who are always just have so many good visual ideas for something that I'm trying to solve a puzzle, and they're just like, "Oh, just do this." Like, oh, it was calculus in my head, but it was so easy for them to think of. That kind of collaboration is the key for that kind of choreography. And we do a dance in our show too, and that's really important to get the students' input on for those kind of dance moves where they're on TikTok and things, then seeing things that are popular that I'm not necessarily seeing. So we appreciate their input on that.
That to me is a really big change over the past 40 years or so, is the incorporation of the color guard more fully, and then also the dancers.
Yes. Well, it's if you think back to the 50s and 60s, the popular auxiliary units, as they may have been called, were majorettes, maybe yeah. rockette lines,
yeah.
and what were called flags or silks. And it was very basic choreography for those. And now you have these single color guard units that are spinning flags, rifles, sabers, all kinds of different techniques and different skills that they need to have in order to put on a show. And that's something that's really remarkable to see, the development in color guard, development in percussion, choreography, all of these things have come so far.
I always wonder where the batons came in.
I think you have to go back to, and we have a lot of history there in the city of Dayton because of Marlene Miller and Fred J. Miller, who are both Dayton people. And Marlene Miller with the Blackhawks had such a strong culture of twirlers and majorettes in this area that really built up the notoriety there to the point where they opened up their own uniform business. And now they're supplying so many uniforms all across the country for marching bands and color guard units.
There's still people trying out for those slots all the time. It's very competitive.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And especially in a lot of college groups that have full majorette lines or featured twirlers, or, you know, like we see drum majors, Ohio State or Michigan with the baton. It's a really, really great tradition.
It's complicated. There's a lot to it. Kenneth Wills, thanks for sharing your insights on the behind the scenes of the marching band. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne. And I just have to say thank you for having this platform. You know, we see marching bands represented on TV or in commercials, and sometimes it's awesome and we love to see that media attention. Sometimes it's clearly just giving some actor who doesn't know how to hold a horn and they're using marching band as a punchline.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing that less and less, and it's because of things like this. So thank you.
You're welcome. That's Kenneth Will. He's director of the Pride of Dayton Marching Band at the University of Dayton. This weekend, the University of Dayton Pride of Dayton Marching Band will host the Bands of Southwest Ohio Regional Championship for High School Bands. That's it for now. Thanks to the All-Sides staff, our senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Matt Rand, assistant producer Bobby Gerberich, video production by the Ohio Channel, board operation by Scott Good. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrola, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks so much for listening. This is All-Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.